Since 1992, he's researched and published extensively on Asia-Africa relations with special focus on China in Africa issues. His latest publication, for which he and his colleagues edited, China Returns to Africa, A Rising Power and a Continent Embrace, has been described as a remarkable book in its judicious summation of the issues of China's involvement in Africa and a remarkably impartial and balanced view, which takes, shall we say, a lot of the hype out of China's involvement in that particular continent. So, as we're starting a little late, without more ado, I'd like to welcome Chris, please.
Thank you very much. I'm going to speak from notes here, unlike one of our colleagues the other evening who was able to speak without the benefit of any notes. I will I'll have drawn some of this some of the ideas I have sketched out here. What I want to talk about is China and Africa, start by with an anecdote. When I moved to South Africa in 1990. And I asked about the Chinese influence in Africa. Now, there was a very modest Chinatown there, a very small Chinatown, and I was pointed in that direction, I asked about investments, I asked about any of the other features you expect of a power, of a state, of consequence, such as China. And it really, no one in South Africa could go beyond a discussion of Chinese restaurants in the neighborhood sort of thing. I found that to be very surprising. And it was on that basis myself and a colleague set up a center looking at generally at East Asian relations in Africa, but more specifically on China itself. In those days, to talk about China and Africa was to discuss Bolivia's relationship with Fiji. It was seen as obscurest and possibly even irrelevant. Today, of course, no one would make that mistake. Both the continent China itself have redefined themselves in the public eye and certainly in the Western eye as significant. And indeed, China's role in Africa is alternatively seen as a source of great benefit or a source of potential threat from Western sources. And what I'd like to do is unpack some of those ideas today, talk about some of the content of that relationship, talk about where that relationship is indeed going, at least from my corner as I see it, and then we can have open it up for discussion. There is a historical, I think it's appropriate to start from a historical position on this, is to say that there was brief Chinese engagement in Africa, one that receives a lot of attention these days in diplomatic communiques, but had essentially been neglected for a better part of a few hundred years. And it's an important one insofar as it communicates something about the China, contemporary China. The historical position was that under the Ming Dynasty, Admiral He went to East Africa, Southern Africa, as part of a general outreach. This outreach to the greater world was cut off, of course, because of domestic circumstances within China. But it did leave an imprint, a Chinese imprint, in the form of some trade that was built on the back of this, an impression of Africa within China. And this was resurrected in more recent years as a way by the Chinese government to describe their intentions in Africa. The point that they wish to make with allusion to this historical example is to say that, unlike the Europeans, we arrived before the Europeans did in Africa. We came to trade. We didn't engage in plunder. We had equal recognition. And indeed, we actually left at the end of the day. Okay? We left Africa intact. It was a meeting of mutual of two civilizations, two communities, and this resurrection of history is important because it communicates to the contemporary African audience what China's intentions are today, and it so hopes to distinguish itself from the West. The Western, the West, of course, as we know, came to Africa and engaged initially in exploitation in the form of the slave trade, ultimately colonialism, and was driven out. And we have the contemporary Africa that we know of today. So this historical period, while perhaps just a blip on the screen, is meaningful in terms of understanding China's attempt to convey what its intentions are in Africa in the contemporary period. The more recent history, of course, is the ideological one, and here we have China playing a role in support of liberation movements, in support of independence. And again, this was very, very well received, and remains. It's a record that is well received in African circles, and it should be said that it's a record that one needs to dig a little deeper on. If you go into Angola, for instance, there's not an Angolan official who, in discussing China-Africa relations, who doesn't remind the Chinese colleagues that they backed the wrong side in the liberation movement. Okay, but that being said, the general trend here is. It is recognized in Africa that China and the People's Republics had supported independence, liberation across the continent as a general principle, if sometimes getting it wrong when it came to specific conflicts, specific regimes in the continent. This ideological period, of course, came to a close by the end of the 1970s, and the more contemporary relationship takes hold. And this brings us closer to the China-Africa phenomena of today. 1982, we see China taking up, deliberately reconfiguring its development assistance. The great projects of the 1960s and 70s, the Tazara or Tanzam Railroad, which were ideologically driven, are quietly placed aside, become part of the history books, and the Chinese officialdom proclaims that relationships within Africa are going to have a commercial dimension. They're going to be mutually beneficial, right? So both parties get something out of it, as it were. But at the same time, this pouring of resources into development assistance projects or infrastructure projects is no longer going to have this ideological tint. So really, the China-Africa relationship that we see today has its roots in 1982 in this particular continental-wide declaration. A Chinese foreign minister toured and made this statement. What's different about today is, of course, that the China of today is a resource-hungry country. It is a country that has recognized the limitations of its own resource base and is looking for resources to fuel the economy, at the same time new markets. The whole going out policy, of which you're, I presume, familiar, is a reflection of this. So this becomes a significant driver of contemporary China's engagement with Africa. Between 1982 and I would mark it by 1996. Chen Zemin took a tour of Africa, and at that stage we see a ratcheting up of China's engagement with the continent. This interest in resources comes at the same time, ironically, that the West has pulled out. Afro-pessimism is gripping the West. Why? Well, they see so much. In some sense, the success of East Asia attracts Western governments to invest and pay attention in the post-Cold War period to developments in East Asia. Interestingly enough, and ironically enough, the door is open for a new set of investors, China being the most prominent, but there were the Malaysians, a whole host of Asian investors move into Africa, and they're really pushing at an open door. Perhaps a decade before it wouldn't have been the case. I think the Japanese experience when they began to invest in Africa was in the 80s was perhaps a bit more difficult than China, Malaysia, Thailand, and the like found. Because the West had expressed a disinterest in Africa. Indeed, coupled with that, the search for resources was coupled to, of course, a diplomatic initiative to check and indeed ultimately checkmate the Republic of China, Taiwan. Ultimately, this dual recognition, the attempts by the Taiwanese to carve out a diplomatic space through dollar diplomacy, by seeking out governments in the developing world. Africa, has been one of the primary sites of that. So we must keep that sense of continuity between the ideological period of the 50s, when this was on the agenda, to the contemporary period as well, where seeking to crowd out the space that Taiwan was carving out for itself in Africa of official recognition was also a determinant of Chinese government actions. A third factor, a driver, I would say, beyond resources and markets for China, is multilateralism. As China becomes a more active multilateralist, obviously since 72 it's been formally involved in the Security Council and the like, but really if you look at the record in the Security Council, abstaining with a few exceptions, the Chinese government has played an inactive role in multilateral institutions. This begins to change in the early 90s. Okay. Up till that time, for instance, the veto is exercised only around questions that relate to Taiwan. Security Council wanting to have a peacekeeping operation in, I think it was Guatemala, which recognized the Republic of China. So this became a site of a source, a rationale for using a veto on the part of the Chinese. But as China becomes more active multilaterally, it looks around and says, where do we find states that share our interests? After the Tiananmen Square incident, after the failed Olympic bid, it was noted in Beijing that the African states remained supportive of China, and there was a kind of reevaluation of what was seen to be too much of a pro-Western outlook emerging out of Beijing. And let's return back. Let's look at remember our African friends, which have exhibited friendship in terms of supporting us in multilateral institution. So that sense that Africa shared similar ideas on questions of sovereignty, non-intervention, human rights, these sorts of things were appealing to the government, and it is a repository of potentially friendly voting if you're working to be an active multilateralist. So that, I think, this is also a factor. How does this reflect in the trade statistics and things like that? Well, you see in 1990 around $1 billion in two-way trade. This last year, $110 billion worth of two-way trade. China has moved from below the top 10 trading partners of Africa to number two spot. Okay. It's certainly poised to go further. There's every indication that it has in the context of the global economic crisis, that its investments will put it in a position to be Africa's leading trading partner. Indeed, I would argue that China's role has fundamentally reshaped Africa's relationship with the external world, the world outside. And one of the reasons has been its policy towards development assistance and investment, which is what I'll turn to now. China's engagement in Africa has been associated in our minds with countries and governments like Sudan that are under boycotts or sanctions by Western or international actors. The explanation from the Chinese side is fairly straightforward to this. I think it's a strategy to break into what was essentially a closed Western market, particularly in the energy sphere. In the realm of energy, they couldn't get access to or raise the interest of potential African partners, be they Angolans or Gabon, what have you, and so they were forced to look at the pariah states, right? First, the states like Sudan. Um, There was an additional point, which is to say that China's technology in the mid-90s was not seen to be world-class. It didn't have much of a exposure. And operating in Sudan in particular would be give it an opportunity to demonstrate that it was capable of putting all aspects of the oil industry, from the upstream activities to the downstream shipping and refining activities, which is indeed what they did. The Sudanese oil industry is, by and large, is mostly a Chinese oil industry, okay, in terms of the technology who's put this in. Before 1996, before China arrived, it was an oil importing country. Okay, so China has, and the ideological justification, if you like, or the justification for moving into Sudan has been that it doesn't concern itself with the domestic affairs of states. This is an ideological position. It's a foreign policy position that's well known in the Chinese setting, it's not concerned with these things. I think that, however, what is interesting about the contemporary China, that is to say the immediate contemporary China of the last few years and the China of just a decade ago, is that they are changing their view on some of these key, maybe not the key principles, but in terms of implementing. Okay, while the rhetoric of no conditionalities remains intact, it is clear, as China has become more exposed in Sudan, in Angola, in Zimbabwe, in any of the countries that much less the less controversial countries, that it's found that to preserve its interests, it does indeed get involved in some of the domestic affairs. Okay, it has an interest in that. So Sudan is perhaps the most dramatic example of this. The Darfur issue, which initially China had taken a very forthright stand in saying it's a domestic affair, we're not going to be involved. Say 2004. After that, the government recognized that there were costs, reputational costs associated with doing this. It's not inconsequential that the Olympics were coming up as well, and NGOs were talking about boycotts and the like. But I do think that the same move, we can see the same sort of move in other settings. So I think this is a general trend, moving closer to some of the positions, some of the concerns that Western governments have. Ironically, Western governments themselves are moving closer to Chinese positions on conditionalities. As you may know, the World Bank, the IMF, have publicly recognized the failure of many of their conditionality policies to structurally change the situation in the political or economic situation in Africa. So this has also been... The arrival of China, in a sense, has opened up an opportunity for Western bankers, Western or international financial institutions to publicly reconsider their policies, their failed policies towards African states or African development. The no conditions policy is a kind of marketing banner, a successful one to break into the African market, but I think that it's the policy of a country trying to gain entry to a region that it was relatively unfamiliar with, and the region was unfamiliar with it. I think today we're seeing an increasingly nuanced approach where there are selected instances of being involved more readily in domestic affairs. Okay. And I'll come to some of those examples later. So the drivers of change, the African response. The African response to China has been overwhelmingly positive. And it's pretty straightforward and simple. As the West withdrew in the 90s, the absence of investment, the abandonment in many respects of regimes that like Mobutu, which the West had tied its fate to quite closely, the abandonment of other regimes which today we would characterize as pariah. Well, they were suddenly cut loose there from Western support. So the arrival of a new actor, one with a Security Council seat, one that was seen to be the rising future, was taken quite positively. And indeed, as African elites have come to know China, the more excited they have become about China's role. I deliberately said African elites because I think there is a different debate emerging within African industry, African trade union movements, and in some areas of civil society. And again, we're dealing with a continent. I should have said this at the beginning. I'm talking about a continent of 53 countries, right? And so everything I say here, is necessarily generalized across 900 million people in a continent. But I think that generally speaking, what I'm saying fits the trend and is appropriate in that way. but we can debate the particular cases in the question and answer. So there was enthusiasm about China. One of the reasons there is enthusiasm, it revolves a bit about this conditionalities business, but I think it's actually more fundamental. And the West likes to focus on the conditions, the conditionality factor, and pariah regimes running into the arms of China as an alternative. Indeed, Robert Mugabe himself, very pithy statement, said, I turn my back on the West where the sun sets and look to the East where the sun rises. And in some sense, that captures the enthusiasm of some governments, but also generally Africans who see the future as being in Asia and the past being in the West, okay, in Europe or North America. But there was enthusiasm for China because China, many, if you take the liberation, for instance, you take the key actors in the liberation movements, many of the people, for instance, in Zimbabwe, Ernest Mnangagwa of ZANU-PF was trained in Nanjing, in the military academy, in the 60s. He knows the China of poverty. He knows the China of hardship. He comes back 30 years later and is bowled over. They've been listening for 20, 30 years to World Bank, to Western donors, tell them the way to develop is to nuance your policies this way, to open your markets, to do that, this, that, and the other thing. Development hasn't occurred. Investment hasn't flowed in. China has done it. To paraphrase what they used to say about the Soviet Union, real existing socialism or real existing capitalism, real existing development occurred in China. And these guys know it's within their own lifetime. And this is what every, all but the most self-serving African leadership will be excited about, embrace the fact that development can happen and that China has shown the way, and they're enthusiastic about it. So this is where some of the enthusiasm comes from. How do we do this? What is the secret that China can bring to Africa? The other source, which I've already alluded to, the other part source of enthusiasm is political stability. Just as we take the Zimbabwean case as an example, traditional donors, traditional political supporters cut support for the Mugabe regime on the basis of electoral politics within that country, China and other Asian states are there to back up or at least provide diplomatic cover. I think it's the Zimbabwean case is worth going into because the economic Mugabe had hoped desperately that there would be all sorts of economic benefits to associating itself with China. The Chinese looked at the situation. I mean, nobody wants to invest in a country that produces 230 million percentage inflation, you know. I mean, so it doesn't matter how much you know, how many diplomatic sessions where you pledge friendship and what have you. Nobody's going to throw their money in that situation. A new source of political stability, a new source of legitimacy from outside. I think this has also been a crucial feature of China's engagement and the enthusiasm that is felt. I mean, in a general way, when China's invested, I've gone around and talked to different African governments in Angola or what have you, for instance, the leading trading partner with China today, and they will recount 2004 when China made its initial bid for an oil lease formed in the form of a general package that included infrastructure development. And they will say that the West would not, the Western donors, the World Bank, were providing us not only less money, they're imposing conditionalities, and they weren't even addressing our needs. We didn't. It's governance is an interesting idea. We may or may not support it, but we actually need roads. We can't eat governance, sort of thing. We need infrastructure and the like. And China, I think this is where the sensibility of a developing country was brought to its approach to Africa, whereas Western donors don't have that. They don't know that you need the hard infrastructure. They seem to have not recognized that you need the hard infrastructure in place before markets can work. You can get all the policies right for all, you know, but if you don't have the communication technology in place, you don't have the roads there, the port facilities don't function, you're not going to get the policies are bound to fail, and indeed as they did. And in belated recognition, we see OECD countries now setting up and putting more of the resources into infrastructure development. So this is another source of the attraction and support that China has from within African circles. And I think that finally that China is a member of the Security Council. I'm not sure African states buy this completely, but certainly the South African government collaborated quite closely with China during its recent tenure as a non-permanent member. And indeed, it's reflected in things like the votes on Myanmar, which was a kind of quid pro quo, if you think of votes on Zimbabwe and the like. And there was quite close consultation between the two to coordinate there. And what African governments want is a friendly voice in the Security Council. And the West hasn't always proven to be the friend that they would want. And they believe that having China there could provide that. I think it's not in every instance, but certainly there is that impulse. The reason we talk about China and Africa today is because, in part, is because of something called the FOCAC, or the China-Africa, the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. The third FOCAC was held in Beijing in November 2006, and this was sort of a coming out party. It was in a sense, an opportunity to display how far this relationship had come in a very short period of time, and the world media fell under the world media spotlight. I would say that rather, while the media discovered China and in Africa at that stage, and the West in certain respects, what we see is not the arrival of China, but we begin to see from that point forward a consolidation of the relationship. We begin to see some changes in the relationship that reflect the long-term commitments and interests that China has and the changing expectations that Africa has on China. Conclude with a couple of observations about the relationship that I think poses challenges for it in the future, this consolidation. One is what could be characterized as Chinese exceptionalism. And here, China has staked its claim to playing to being different in Africa on the fact that it's on history, as I alluded to in the very first comments about having been in Africa in the past, yet at the same time not exploited the Africans, had not taken up not created colonies or any of this sort of thing. So China has said that the relationship is one of mutual benefit and equals and all of this. Julius Nyerere's response to this was it's the most unequal of equal partnerships. But nonetheless, he recognized the form of equality, but the content of that relationship remains economically, and all the measures of power, quite asymmetrical. Managing this idea of China being different places an enormous burden, I think, on the Chinese state to demonstrate that time and time again. It is being called to question by African states. African observers are holding China to a different standard than the West in some way. And that's a self-imposed position that the Chinese have assumed. And I think it's one that's going to continue to make it difficult. It's going to be an issue, shall we say, throughout the relationship, at least the near contemporary period. Because the profile, if you look purely, if you strip away all rhetoric and you're an economist and you just interpret China's through its trade and investment relationship, it doesn't look that different from traditional partners. Its trade is in the resource sector. It's investing in that. Yet, granted, it provides some infrastructure packages alongside those things, not to be sneered at. In that sense, it's somewhat different. But they're providing manufactured goods. They're putting African firms out of business, particularly in South Africa, because they're so highly competitive. All the same reasons that China's being raising problems with the manufacturing industries in Europe as well, of course. There's the competitiveness, the ability to underprice or manufactured goods. And this is raising disquiet, and indeed sometimes quite active disquiet, in some African circles. So the burden of proof of Chinese difference, of this exceptionalism, is called to question under these circumstances. The other one is, I would say, the nature of government-to-government relationship. State-to-state, the emphasis has been on state-to-state relations with a disregard for other sectors within African society. It reflects Chinese interests. It reflects, in a certain way, the structure of who owns the oil leases, who controls the resources that China wants. Well, you're going to have to go to the government. You're going to have to make your deal with Bongo and Gabon. It's no, it's not going to be done any other way. But the elite nature of this relationship is introducing problems for China, Chinese foreign policy and its success there. Why? In some sense, because we can see it best in countries like Zambia, where the belief, partly verified, partly mythical, that China's getting a special deal from any other external actor in its access to resources and the like, has translated into an entire political campaign that is essentially built around an anti-Chinese platform. Opposition movements within many African countries are using the association with China as a means, stirring xenophobia, and as a means of trying to win votes within some sectors of Africa. Say the trade union movements that are unhappy with Chinese practices in labor, what have you. Third, this elite. The elite nature of the relationship, I think, imposes certain costs and is going to be difficult for China to manage. A third area is, if I can return to the idea of exceptionalism, China says it's exceptional. We can identify areas where it is exceptional in its relationship with African governments and its attempt to consult more widely, et cetera, et cetera. But perhaps from the perspective of the African, average African on the ground, what makes China most exceptional, it's the only trading partner, significant trading partner, that is sending migrants, if I use this word very loosely, sojourners perhaps, to the continent. And this is how the average African is reading the Chinese relationship. And now, that doesn't mean that's a bad thing, but certainly in some cases, it's produced friction, okay? In some cases, and I think Zambia is one of those cases. Other cases, it hasn't produced friction. Indeed, the largest 50% of the the migrants have come to South Africa, where it's a very different economic situation than some of the other countries in the continent. So their economic opportunities are more great, or greater, I should say, in South Africa than they would be necessarily in some of the other countries. So I think that this notion of exceptionalism, as understood at the ground, is more about new Chinese communities springing up and less about rhetoric and consultation and Security Council support or any of these things. And I think this introduces a dysfunction and a challenge to the Chinese government as it manages a long-term sustainable, what will be a long-term sustainable relationship between, as they would say, the world's largest developing country and the largest continent the continent with the most developing countries. I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Chris, thank you very much indeed.